At that time, was there any kind of organization around the gay village? I mean, was there any kind of links between the various businesses?
No, absolutely not.
So when did that, how did that start to happen? How did that begin to be managed?
Well, I started the magazine in 92, I think, right. 92.
And was it, you just decided to start that magazine?
No.
Did you have other magazines before?
Yeah, I had a magazine before called Impact, which was a sort of a listings magazine about the straight scene in Brighton.
Right.
And I wasn't really interested in
was
magazines.
Was it a free magazine?
It was a free magazine. Yes. I wasn't interested in magazines, but through the printing side of things, we were lumbered with it because it basically was going bust.
Yeah.
Owed us a print bill, and so we ended up with the magazine.
We ended up having to do it.
That's right. So G-Scene started as a four-page insert into the centre of this straight magazine. And it was fascinating how it happened, because it grew from being a four-page insert in the straight magazine to being a sort of a 48-page magazine.
Yeah.
Within six months, it was astonishing.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
And this thing had just been waiting to happen. People had been waiting for something to tell them, and the way that we approached it at the time was we had a very strong campaigning edge to everything we did. We were never a fluffy gay magazine. We always had a very strong campaigning edge, and of course that that tended to put people into two camps. They either loved what we did or they hated what we did, and they hated me for rocking the boat.
Yeah.
So that was always a very difficult one to manage, because you know at that time most of the power brokers were the rich gay men that lived in Sussex Square.
Yes.
The irony of it was that one of the glossy magazines 2 years ago produced their sort of Brighton's top 20 power brokers, and I was number four above all the politicians. So I thought, isn't it funny how things turn around? So they agreed to start giving seed funding to all the gay organisations.
Right.
Now, up until then, not one gay organisation in Brighton got any funding. Even Switchboard didn't get any funding.
Right.
The in 1992, the council gave a £5,000 grant to the Pride at that time, and the Argus just went crazy.
Really.
And just just wouldn't let it go, and it almost brought down the Labour administration at the time.
Really?
That's why Pride has always remained a very sensitive issue politically in Brighton, because of that one thing happening. And after that, they just wouldn't. So after 92, they just wouldn't fund anything. So all the we didn't have many groups in the early 90s. We had Switchboard, and then when Zorro reported, all the money became available, so groups started forming, because they knew that they could go and get their £5,000 grant to start up, and then they could go back every year to get the same
kind of structure.
That created the structure that became the voluntary sector as we know now.
So one of the things you were doing was fundraising.
That's right.
Did you have to just do it from scratch? Did you train yourself? Did you get trained? Did you have a big network of rich people?
No. I mean, that's the beauty of it. It was done without rich people.
Yeah.
It was Zorro was done with with Joe Public helping, and it wasn't until the very end of it where George agreed to come and do the final fundraiser, because we were about £3,000 short of finding the money to print the report. Yeah. At that time, it was in 95, internet was in its very early days. It was really important to get the report printed. Anyway, he sort of came and did the final thing for us, and we got the money to print the report. But now I made it up as I went along, actually. And because there wasn't the precedent, there wasn't a rule book to go to say, what do I do? But also because there hadn't been a real model to work to in Brighton, it was quite easy. The subtext to that is that in the in 1990, a charity started called Brighton Cares. And they saw all the problems that would come with funding of HIV, and they used to do shows to raise money. And then in 1992, the Argus went after them big time. It was at the time when the Argus were rabidly homophobic.
Yeah.
And they, what's the name, they attacked the charity for paying a director to work. And the point of the director was he was basically a fundraiser.
Yeah.
He put the shows on and he raised the money. The Argus didn't get it. And against a backdrop of this organisation setting up and having a fabulous board of trustees, included Jack Tinker. I mean, they did the PR side of it well, but the Argus didn't like the fact that that what was perceived as a gay charity, and it
Yes.
wasn't a gay charity. It was very much a mainstream charity, but it was a HIV charity, which meant it was gay in the eyes of the mainstream media. Just went for them big time, drove the fellow out of town.
Really.
He then went on to be to he went to South Africa. He was Divine's manager, the drag queen.
Oh, right.
His name was Bernard J. He went to South Africa and then controlled all the media events in South Africa. So we lost this opportunity
To have that wonderful
to have
person,
that wonderful person
yeah.
here. And you know, he had contact with, I mean, at that time they were talking about bringing Liza Minnelli to the Brighton Centre. So the plans were fantastic, but they were kiboshed by the Argus,
Right.
and he was run out of town. He was treated appallingly.
So, as the AIDS thing moved on and developed, and the deaths and the whole kind of illnesses,
Yeah.
I lived through it obviously as well in London. Could you see any light at the end of the tunnel in terms of this kind of constantly sapping?
When it was happening, I could see no light at the end of the tunnel. And issue-wise, it was most probably, and it's to a funny sort of extent, it still is now. It was the hardest thing that we had to deal with in trying to pitch the giving of information each month with, you know, reporting on the people that had died. I mean, I remember one classic month when we must have had 15 obituaries in the magazine, and it was really difficult because there was never a good news story, and so it sort of put us into a mindset of being like that all the time. And it took me, I remember it took me a long time to recognize that and to say, actually, we're going to approach the AIDS and HIV thing from a different angle and let the people that get the government money do that. Let them tell you about the news of it and let us start talking about fundraising and things like that and supporting the groups that do well in Brighton. And so what I did is I let the magazine champion the organisations I knew were delivering the services. So I suppose the subtext to my agenda is that you can always tell who we support and who we don't. And I've always been very vocal and very upfront with who we do support. And whereas I very rarely go on the record as to who we don't support, it's very clear from the way that
Yes, from their absence.
From their absence, that you know that I will only support organisations that are about the their victim focus, so to speak, rather than you know these big corporate organisations that it's not clear what they're doing.
So, when you made this change and when you started to focus more on that, did it take a long time to bite, you know, to bed down, or was it quite quick to change?
It was quite quick to change, actually. One of the things we used to do is we used to do these big parties called Red Hot Poker Parties,
Right.
and international DJs would come from all over the world to play them, and they used to raise a lot of money. So I suppose that change happened at that time, and people started partying positively.
Can you put a date to that?
I think that would have been about 96, actually. Right. 96, 98.
Right, yes.
And there was a shift, and you could link that into the use of ecstasy and MDMA culture and yes. The raves. And the whole thing created a shift within the community. And the community were extensively using drugs. They were using ecstasy, but it was a time when the ecstasy was very nice, and you know, it wasn't cut with rubbish like it is now. And when you went into a place, it was always uplifting and happy.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
And for a period of 3 years, I just went out and partied. I have to say, between the age of when was it? Between the age of 38 and 42.
Best years.
Yeah. And I'm glad I did it then and not when I was younger. Yeah.
So where were you living at this time?
I was living in Tong Dean Road.
Oh, right.
Which is at the top of Dyke Road.
Yeah.
It was called Millionaire's Road.
Quite posh.
It was very posh. And I'd always wanted to live in a big house. Because where I was originally, it was in Windmill Street, which is behind American Express. And it was just a little terraced house,
yeah.
You know, with a big lounge downstairs and two bedrooms upstairs. And I'd always wanted to live in a big house. And I was living with a Colombian boyfriend at the time, and his family used to come over regularly, and there was about 11 people in the family.
Right.
So I thought, well, if we can have a house and live happily ever after. So I bought the house, and the family would come and stay for long periods of time. But nobody came to visit.
Interesting.
And you see, when I was in the backside of Kemptown,
yeah.
And then I moved into the factory here in Farm Road, people would drop in all the time.
Yes.
The moment you went up the top of Dyke Road,
it feels too far away.
It feels too far away, and people wouldn't make the effort, and they wouldn't come. And I used to get actually quite lonely by it all. And I also got fed up with the family being round, and because Spanish aren't quiet. You know, you sit down for dinner, and they don't talk. They shout at each other. And so I stayed in the house for 2 years, and then came to live right back in the centre of town, in Farm Road, which I had 3 two-bedroom flats on top of the factory.
Right.
And so I lived in one of those.
Right.
And they were the happiest times I had, because it was right in the centre of town.
Yeah.
We could park. We had Muse parking. And, you know, I could just go downstairs and work, and if I didn't want to work, I could stay downstairs. And I loved it. And the best part of it was that people would just pop in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a much more of a community feel then.
So did you start to, I mean, competitors is probably not the right word, but were there other gay magazines being produced in Brighton at that time?
Well, what happened was, the Argus had, for years, had a homophobic editor. Whose name I can't even remember now. And they changed the editor to somebody called Simon Bradshaw, who was clearly a liberal, clearly more enlightened, and changed the Argus's whole approach to dealing with sensitive issues.
Right.
And then after 1 year's Pride, they did this fabulous spread on Pride for the first time ever in the Argus. People, mainstream readers, saw the event. And so I just wrote a letter to the editor of the Argus saying, nice, this is happening now, and you're presenting all facets of the many different types of communities that are in Brighton. And I got on very well with him, and then one day he rang me up and he said, oh, you're not going to like this. I said, what's that? He said, the people above me have decided we're going to do a gay magazine. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so I said, when are you doing it? He said, it'll get off the ground in about 3 months. So at that time, GCN was still black and white inside with just a colour cover.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, I'm going to have to put this magazine into full colour. So I put it into full colour and went head to head with the Argus, and they lost a fortune.
What did they call their magazine?
360.
Oh, that was it. Yes. Ah, I didn't realise it was Argus bit. Oh, yeah, right.
So that, the 360 was born out of the Argus buying in to the misconception that the pink pound in Brighton was valuable. Right. So they wanted to get, they wanted to get all of this fabulous pink pound that was there, that was never there.
Mm.
And all my advertisers, basically only one switched. So all of my main advertisers
were loyal. Yes.
Were loyal. And they tried everything.
Mm.
And then one day, the editor of the Argus rang me and he said, you've won. What did he say? He said, we're giving it up. So I thought, oh, well, you know, that's a bit of a relief, because you can't run two gay magazines in a town.
It just isn't bigger than that.